This is Arts Alive, the podcast of the St. Pete Catalyst. My name is Bill DeYoung, but you probably knew that if you tuned in already. Happy to welcome today Michael Francis, who is celebrating his first decade. Is it decade or decade?
Decade.
Okay. He's English, you know. His first decade, his first 10 years as music director of the Floral Orchestra, which is a pretty nice milestone to reach. First of all, before we go there, I have to ask you, were you impacted by the storm? And you and yours, are they okay?
Yeah, thanks for asking, Bill. Actually, I was in Germany until Sunday night, so we avoided the storm, and we live up in Odessa, so quite a long way from the coast. So we were okay, but as you can imagine, seeing the images while we're abroad in Europe and then flying back and hearing the stories of friends, colleagues, and just it's just been dreadful.
Were you in Germany? Were you hearing reports of what was happening here? Oh, my God.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And not only that, everybody in the orchestra is there asking what's happening in Florida. It's major news all over the world, so you can't avoid it.
Yeah.
But having now lived in our home for the last 5 or 6 years, starting with Ian and Irma and Idalia, was it? I forget the names of them.
Yep.
So we've seen them come through, but fortunately they don't reach where we are. But of course that doesn't affect us, feeling really terrible for those who it does reach.
You know, this is part and parcel of what you always talk about, how we are one big community. And we want to talk about this weekend season opener, the first Masterworks show of the season, which is technically the season opener. Also, what you do in the community, because there's so much that the Floral Orchestra does in the community. And so you really were feeling this. Like, were there musicians in the orchestra who had some issues and stuff?
Absolutely. We've had musicians and staff and board members, as well as other people that we know, directly affected. We have people within a TFO family who are not able to be in their homes at the moment. Genuine devastation on the levels that we've seen in the newspapers. So, yeah, we really are seeing that happening up close and personal. And I think for us is that an orchestra is always designed to bring people together, to avoid the discussions that consistently divide us. And yet at the same time, be open about it. For example, when you come to a concert, if the music is about politics and religion, we'll talk about it. But we're not going to give our opinion about things such as what's coming up in November. That's not what we do. Our job is to be a haven. And our job is to create a place where people can come and just get away from what's going on around them, which probably right now is something even more important than ever before. If you've been through a life-changing experience. I mean, our concert master, Jeff Malta, lives in North Carolina partly. Ooh. And he had a genuine near-death experience in terms of what he went through. So when you see that with dear close friends and colleagues, you realize that music's great gift is to come together, to sit together, just to take that moment, not only just to have 2 hours or so of respite from cleaning and just getting rid of furniture and all the dreadful things that people have to do, but also just through imagination, be taken to a totally different place. And to actually be encouraged to be uplifted, there's still tremendous beauty in this world. And to hear a symphony orchestra play at its best is just one of the great miracles of humanity. It is the most extraordinary thing to see these highly skilled, remarkable musicians playing infinitesimally precise music together, which is designed for the joy and the peace of everybody.
It is Saturday and Sunday at Ruth Eckert Hall, both shows, which is, we're going to talk about the program in a minute, but the orchestra has partnered with Habitat for Humanity Tampa Bay Gulfside to collect cleaning and safety supplies for those impacted by Helene. This is, I don't know that it's unprecedented, but it's pretty darn cool. Let's put it that way. And at these concerts, you'll have bins, right? Sort of bring us stuff.
That's exactly right. So not only are we here to try to help you and be encouraged to be uplifted, to be just that respite from it all, but at the same time, people need batteries. They need cleaning supplies. They need all sorts of things, just pragmatic things to actually get through what we're going through. So we want to make sure that our patrons feel like they can help, but at the same time, there'll be many people who desperately need it, who can come to the concerts. Likewise, they can go to Habitat for Humanity, and we do hope that we can in some small way contribute to the necessity of the people here in Tampa Bay.
You have, your community outreach has expanded quite a bit in the last couple of years, and I was thinking specifically, what really just I thought was the coolest thing was the chamber concerts in the Church of the Ascension and places like that. You've always said, I want to bring music to people where they are, you know, as opposed to just come and see us. That's Absolutely. Important. Why is that important to you?
Well, I think if you believe in this art form, then you can't allow certain things to prevent people having that, whether it be financial, geographical, or whatever the things that they think divide them from this art form. We want to say no, it's not true. There should be no barrier to access. So if you can't come to our concert hall, or perhaps you've never been to a concert hall, well, we're still going to come to you because this music is amazing. Live music, watching people come together, sharing it in an experience, sitting next to many, many different kinds of people. It's just so powerful. So the sound waves or the chamber concert series that we do has been very successful. Mm-hmm. And it gives us, you know, this is in some ways was an offshoot of how we responded to COVID, is that we divided the orchestra into two and we had a smaller and a bigger orchestra. And we saw that people enjoyed not only the repertoire, but at the same time that it gave us this flexibility to now go to the churches, to the various places, mm-hmm. the smaller theaters, and these rather more intimate settings allow us to communicate with the audience in a wonderful and personal way.
I think also when you do those Pops concerts that I guess Chelsea Gallo conducts now, that's also a matter of outreach, and it's just come and hear music you like.
Absolutely.
You know, there's no abject lesson to it or, you know, you're not supposed to take anything away from it, but this felt good.
I mean, and that is powerful in itself. I mean, I think what an orchestra is, it's not just Beethoven. Of course, we love to perform Beethoven. He's one of the great masters of all time. But at the same time, it is Barbara Streisand. It is, you know, there's so many shows coming up. There's music of British knights, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Elton John, and Paul McCartney.
Bet, Babs, and Beyond.
That's it, Bet, Babs, and Beyond. What a great title.
I thought they went bankrupt. No, it's Bet, Bath, and Beyond. Sorry, bad joke, folks.
Yeah. So I think that variety that we offer is just so big, whether it be rock or pop or How to Train Your Dragon or Christmas concerts, like great masterworks like this weekend.
Yeah.
And outreach and children, youth concerts. We really do make sure that we reach the entire panoply of all of society.
Well, you've expanded. You're doing you do Tampa Opera now, correct?
Yes, we do Opera Tampa, that's right.
Yeah. Oh, Opera Tampa. Yeah, close. Sorry, enough. Robin, but yeah.
That's all right, it's close enough. And I'm conducting Bernstein's Candide there, which is more of an operetta, really, mm-hmm. in January. So we have a full season there. I mean, it's just amazing. Our chance to really, I think the only way you can imagine, what does an orchestra do? Well, imagine life without us. And you'd see the amount of live music and the amount of people who come together for a huge variety of concerts that we do. If that's gone, that would just be so shocking. Mm-hmm. And that you kind of, one of those things that an orchestra, we've been here for 57 years. But we are an integral part of the artistic life of Tampa Bay.
To that point, your CEO, Ignacio Barón Vieira, put forth the idea of the Center for Music Education and Innovation, which is a $30 million complex that he wants to build, that you want to build, adjacent to the Mahaffey Theater. And there's fundraising going on, and this is something that people are thinking about. Tell me why it's necessary for the orchestra and the community both that this happen.
Well, I'll just give you an example of today. We were rehearsing up in New Tampa, up in near Hillsborough. I forget what's the name of the...
The New Tampa Performing Arts
Center.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Keith is a friend of mine.
Yeah, Keith Arsenal there. So we were great. We're very, very happy to be there. But you mentioned all our musicians, all our orchestra, everything going right up there. And then some days then we go back to Mahaffey, or we go to the Strass Center, or we go to Ruth Eckert Hall.
Yeah.
So just the mileage that we do, the impact upon instruments, and just the sheer complication that we have of not having a venue and not having a place to rehearse and not having a home is so difficult. We're one of the few orchestras in the country at our size and scale that does not have a home. And we perform in various places, obviously mainly in terms of the amount of concerts at the Mahaffey, but likewise many at Ruth Eckert Hall and the Strass. So what we desperately need is somewhere, not only where we can rehearse, but it's somewhere where we can bring people. We can have a smaller intimate sort of concert hall for smaller concerts within it.
Do chamber shows and
same things. The offices can be there, the library. I mean, our library is not near our concert halls. No other orchestra works under the difficult logistical conditions that the Florida Orchestra does. And yet we're consistently reaching the highest artistic levels, but despite what we have to go through.
Heard and understood. What does it do for the community, though? Is there an educational component to this?
Huge, yeah.
Yeah.
Because what an orchestra should be is a center for education and innovation. So as we're moving forward and more technology, of course, the innovation thing is huge, and there's great potential for us And for us to have a home where we can record, where we can rehearse, where we can then release videos to schools, where we can start to really educate, we can bring schools in, where we can have teaching labs going on within there. We can continue inside the music on a much more personal level, and we can just expand our education. And that becomes not only when we're working, but when we're not there, youth orchestras can rehearse there. It becomes the center of musical education in Tampa Bay.
Can you address why the Mahaffey, I mean, they've got a couple of big parking lots, and I understand where this will supposedly go, but I mean, how that decision was reached, let's do it here, as opposed to Tampa or Clearwater or, you know, Odessa.
Well, I think the main thing is our need is palpable. So we're looking at this as an option, and it seems like a good one, and I know that the city is looking to create a center of the arts and for the arts.
In that area, sure. Yeah,
absolutely. So it seems like a logical place for us to really create this this new center right there.
Yeah.
And you know, we'd love to be partnering even more closely with the Mahaffey, where we can rehearse and we can do what we need to do there, but at the same time do our concerts there and continue to perform at the Strass Center and Ruth Eckert.
Do you have a preference personally? You probably wouldn't tell me. Anyway, I should get on the mic and say this. I wondered if you had a personal preference as to the three. Ferguson Hall, I guess, is your home in the Strass for the most part. Not Ferguson Hall, Morsani Hall.
Both.
Okay, because I've seen you. I saw you rehearse in Ferguson.
Yeah, we've rehearsed and we perform in both, yeah.
Okay, Ruth Eckert Hall and the Mahaffey. Do you have, acoustics? This one's better. I mean, I know you can't say it, but I'm putting you on the spot and asking you anyway.
Yeah, and you're welcome to ask the question, and you're right that I will avoid it. And what I will say is that I love each place has its own unique audience.
Yeah.
And each audience responds to different music at different times. So, you know, Friday night in the Ferguson or in Morsani in Tampa, it's its own vibe as people sort of come off work and it's very exciting. Saturday night is probably our largest audience in Mahaffey, and that's probably the most established and stable. But also on Sunday night, there's something beautiful about going there. And that's our third concert often on the weekend. So everything is really finely tuned, and we enjoy performing everywhere, and we wanted to see packed out halls in all venues.
Now, we've spoken about programming many, many times, and it really is above and beyond your role as a musician and a researcher and a conductor and an interpreter. Just programming a season is a very integral part of your job, of what you do. Let's talk about opening night, which is Saturday at Ruth Eckert Hall. This is Bolero and some other cool stuff, which we'll get to. It was originally going to be in the Mahaffey. I understand they had some electrical issues over there, and they had to do some last-minute post-Helene mumbo-jumbo switching around. So you moved it to Ruth Eckert Hall, which is where you were going to be Sunday anyway. Okay, let's talk about this program. Yeah, obviously, you're doing Ravel's Bolero, but you've got some other interesting stuff too. How about if I just shut up and you tell me about what's happening this week?
Yeah, I'm always interested when we come back to open the season as to how to grab the audience with tremendous excitement. I mean, so Ravel's Bolero is one of the most iconic pieces of music. It's loved. But I was thinking about, what is it? Well, it's a dance. It's connected to Spain, or should I say more the Basque country. Mm-hmm. And it has this beautiful rhythm, and it just builds up and up and up. And I thought about other pieces that connect it. And there's a great piece by, the second half is Villa-Lobos, Chorus number 10. He's a Brazilian composer. And this music feels, it starts like you're listening to a Stravinsky or Picasso painting the Amazon or writing music about it. And then it ends up with this music that is the most primal, tribal, exciting music.
It's just
hardcore, exciting, amazing Brazilian salsa, samba, rock and roll, has everything. It's just astonishing. So, and it's with full choir, with a master chorale.
The master chorale, yeah. You know, dare I say, this is something else we talk about when we talk about programming. Someone from, you know, the great unwashed, such as myself, who doesn't have, you know, the sort of encyclopedic, thank you, Bill. Thank you, Michael. Understanding of how these things work, but Bolero is like a greatest hit.
Yeah.
It's like Beethoven 5, which you're going to do, you know, I know Bolero, I remember it from that movie.
Ten, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So you have to keep that in mind, right? Yeah. They're going to know what this is. Even name recognition, I know Ravel's Bolero.
But what's going to be interesting is that they're going to go away talking all the time about the pieces that they didn't know. And that I can assure by Villa-Lobos, and then the Borodin Polovotsian Dances. Well, that's an orchestral piece, but originally it's from an opera, Prince Igor. And when you hear it with full choir, it is so powerful. So the three second halves, all the pieces in the second half are about this sort of primitive dance form, but dressed up in the most exciting, exhilarating music. It is just going to blow people off their chairs. And then when we get to the first half, we begin with Chabrier Spania, which is just this beautiful picture postcard of a Frenchman's imagination of what Spain is, and Manuel de Falla's Nights in the Garden of Spain, which is an evocative piano concerto. Think of the Alhambra, think of Granada, think of that sort of rather delicate feeling you have having had a big lunch, big siesta, go out in the evening, you start to hear the butterflies, the birds. It's just pure magic.
This is the way you talk when you explain these things to people. You picture the butterflies and the magic. Okay, the second weekend is Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 3. Can we go to November 2nd and 3rd, which is Beethoven 5?
Yeah.
Da-da-da-da.
Yes.
And
the other most famous beginning.
Which is Strauss. You say Sprach Zarathustra. That must have been a no-brainer. You say great beginnings.
Yeah, and well, that's also connect. That was the first concert I ever conducted with the orchestra back in October 2013. So I was thinking in this.
How portentious. Here I come.
Yes, absolutely. I have arrived.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And that is, of course, used in 2001 Space Odyssey. Of course, and yeah. any other.
When Elvis came on stage.
When Elvis, the Simpsons used. I mean, it's sort of iconic. Everyone knows it. Yeah. And those are the two most famous beginnings of any major piece of music.
Your timpani player gets a workout on that just one. Yeah.
Fun. It's a blast. And the trumpet, the organ, it's got everything you want in it. But for me, it was a chance to really reflect upon a piece that when we started to where we are now. It's one of the great orchestral show pieces. This is Richard Strauss, is Alsesprach Zarathustra, based on Friedrich Nietzsche's book. And then Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, this iconic, but we're actually performing it in an arrangement or retouching or reorchestration by Gustav Mahler. So it's bigger. Mahler looked at Beethoven and thought, well, we can't perform it with modern instruments, so let's add more instruments. And he redid some of the orchestration, and I just recorded all of these elsewhere in Germany. So it's a chance to bring that here. It's very, very exciting. So it's Beethoven, but sort of with on steroids.
I like that. I think you've used that before, but that was awesome. Good. It's an evergreen. You should keep saying that. You had the program there in front of you. Let's go down the Masterworks list, and what else would you like to highlight?
Well, I think it's exciting that Chelsea Gallo, our resident conductor, who's doing such a fantastic job with the morning matinee series, and she is going to be in the morning matinees really featuring our musicians with different concertos, clarinets.
Those are always at Mahaffey, or are they?
And also Ruth Eckert Hall.
Oh, okay.
So those are 11 o'clock concerts, but they're really about the talent within the Florida Orchestra. But she has a concert in February, which is about the sea, and it features Garth Neustadter's Seaborn, which is a film. So you watch the film of the sea, and we have the Percussion Collective, who opened the season last year, and they had these four percussionists, like this ballet of hitting things at the front. And that's going to be amazing. And then we finish that concert with La Mer. And we have, of course, incredible new talent coming here. Great new conductors, Kitaro Harada and Nicholas Hirsch returns. And then we have Joseph Young, a brilliant conductor who's coming with his brother, Robert Young, to do a saxophone concerto. Guillaume Connaisson's A Kind of Train about John Coltrane. Jeff Malta, our wonderful concertmaster, will be leading without conductor Vivaldi's Four Seasons and with some Mozart.
That's lovely.
Very exciting. And for me, one of the two programs I'm really very excited about for me, which I'm conducting, Olga Kern, the great pianist, is coming to play with the orchestra, Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1, and William Walton's Belshazzar's Feast, the most amazing oratorio about, of course, the famous feast with the hand of the writing, many, many tackle.
Oh, of course. In. Of course, yeah.
Yeah. but this is just so spectacular, so loud, full choir. And we have and Donny Ray Albert, who sang Mendelssohn's Elijah, is coming back.
Sure, I remember him. Yeah.
You've got to get an interview with him because he has the greatest voice ever. And we finished the season with Copland's Symphony No. 3, and we're bringing Simon Bartow. And Simon Bartow just lives up the road, and he's an international star pianist, and he's playing the Gershwin and Copland Symphony No. 3, which was my first concert as music director. So I thought, 10 years later, nice to return to that amazing piece.
Oh, I thought you conducted the Strauss as your opening
concert. That was my first as a guest conductor. It's different. And then we finish with Mahler's Symphony No. 3, which is, I just saw this, by the way, 2 weeks ago in Frankfurt when I was over there. I watched it live because I haven't seen it for a few years. It's just the most astonishing piece. It's so powerful. Features big solo trumpet, solo trombone. Of course, we have amazing musicians in Joel Vase and Rob Smith. But this with children's choir, with the ladies from the Master Chorale and everything, it is from the foundation of the world to the top of the heavens. It's the most outrageously epic musical masterpiece.
Does that happen to you, Michael? I mean, do you say, I've just seen this in a concert hall in Europe somewhere. I can't wait to bring this to Tampa Bay.
Well, I'd already programmed it, but when I found out that it was being performed, I thought, I want to go and see it live myself.
Oh, yeah.
Because usually I'm the one conducting or playing in it. So I played it in the double bass section of the London Symphony.
Yeah.
But I realized I haven't watched it or heard it live myself. So, yeah, I love to go and see concerts when I can. I don't get many opportunities because I'm usually busy, but I really love watching the Florida Orchestra when I'm not conducting. Uh-huh. I do enjoy that. I'm not sure they enjoy it when I'm there, but I enjoy it. It just gives me a chance to sort of get a sense of what's the audience experience like and how's the orchestra communicating to us, and also just to take pride in these amazing musicians. I think we're up to 33, 34 musicians that I've hired. I mean, so just to see this talent coming in, as well as, of course, all these amazing musicians who've been with the orchestra for more years.
So it's 70 pieces, 80?
68, 69. Something. Yeah, 68 musicians and 2 conductors.
Here's a question I've always...
A partridge and a pear tree.
Here's a question I've always had, and it's going to sound very dumb, but that's kind of the way I roll here. Arrhythmia is a concept I'm familiar with. How is it when you're up there and you're conducting all these moving parts, how is it that it doesn't just fall apart into arrhythmia and catastrophe?
Yeah.
How do you control all of that? Or do you?
You know, you do. I mean, because actually a lot of this music, if you hear it without a conductor, it's very hard to bring it together. Mm. So conducting is odd, and I wish everybody had a chance to do it. The problem with conducting is that you're not making sound. Unless you're grunting and sniffing and breathing, the musicians are, but you're trying to always conduct ahead so they know where to play. It's a little bit like sort of if you're shooting a clay pigeon, you shoot to where the clay pigeon's going,
uh-huh.
and then the things that collide. Well, it's the same thing with conducting. You're gesturing so that they know where to play. And so it's always this game of leading but listening. You're trying to conduct sometimes behind the beat to slow it down with them to give them confidence and to get ahead of them if we have to speed up or it's a new tempo change. So your brain is not operating exactly what the music's happening like a pianist is, pressing buttons or string players pulling bows. We're always ahead in our brains. So there's a disconnect between what you're thinking and what your hands are doing.
That just sounds incredibly complex.
Do I make myself sound like a genius? Because that's the plan.
Yeah, you do. Well, I mean, hats off to you, man.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I wish it is that. Sometimes it feels a little bit like alchemy. Sometimes it feels a little bit like something out of a Harry Potter film.
Well,
other times it's just me taking the credit for their incredible talent.
Let's talk about the pop series a little bit. I mean, James Newton Howard is coming here to kind of conduct all these famous film scores. And I suppose that's the sort of thing where you go, well, it's available this year. Can I work it in? And does he just sort of shows up and brings the scores and your guys sort of say, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think it's one of those programs that Bob Moyer is our artistic consultant. He and I work together on all the programming.
Yeah.
And so he knew of this and said, well, let me give him a call and let's take it from there, and it worked out. So we're just very excited.
What about these film things where you have sort of Harry Potter or animated stuff? I mean, somebody's doing The Last Airbender or something in the Strauss Center this weekend, not you guys. Those just sort of travel the world as a something you can sort of buy into. Would you like to add this to your season? Is that how that works?
Yeah, so they've many films now, they've kept all the dialogue and sound effects but extracted the music.
Yeah.
And then they've created the... I mean, interesting is for me, in my life as a double bass player, I was recording those films originally for the movies. So, you know, Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, all those ones, I'm on those soundtracks.
You're on the Star Wars soundtrack.
Yeah.
With the LSO, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we would get a sheet of music that would say 5M3B, and it would be a 17 or a second or a 2 minute clip about, I don't know, a Jedi killing a goblin or that I've crossed.
Lord of the Rings, I think.
Cross pollinated. But with the film, you're seeing the whole thing. Now, I've conducted it.
Yeah.
I've done Wizard of Oz and I've done Casablanca. The hardest thing I've ever conducted. Do you know why? Those munchkins are never in rhythm. And so you're trying to guess what's going to happen with someone who's died 60 years ago on stage, on the screen, and that is so difficult.
When you aren't the conductor for Masterworks, sometimes maybe Chelsea will do one. Why? Is it just because you're out of town, or I want a break, or I hate that piece? Or
no, I think, as music director, yes, I do get first dibs on the music, of course. But, part of my role is to invite other conductors as well, and then to make sure that all the repertoire works together. I think like any organization, so what's interesting is that every Sunday or Monday, all around the world, all of the conductors, we kind of shift. We either go back to our home orchestra or we go and guest conduct somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
So that there's variety for the audience as well.
Uh-huh.
So they don't just get to see the same one, they get to see a nice variety of
colors. Well, we're just looking at your back, essentially, the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. It's my best feature is the back of my head, apparently, yeah. So we just make sure there's a good variety of artists.
I do have a last question, though, and I definitely wanted to ask this. And again, apropos of nothing, Yo-Yo Ma is coming on the 28th for the gala, or gala, as if you will.
Gala.
It's been a decade since I had to say that. That's at Ruth Eckert Hall. Usually do those at the Mahaffey. Is there any particular reason? Was it a date thing?
Grand Prix.
It's Grand Prix.
Grand Prix.
Oh.
Yeah, that was it. So it just, I think it, that was, it all kind of,
yeah.
Sometimes the things move and we're thrilled at the Grand Prix here, but it was a direct clash.
He's doing the Dvorak.
Yo-Yo Ma coming here. I mean, think about what the artists that we bring, whether it be Sting or Itzhak Perlman and Yo-Yo Ma. I mean, these are the great stars of the world. So to have him come, it's going to be absolutely astonishing. He's playing the Dvorak Cello Concerto.
Yes, it's just my wife's favorite piece. And we saw him in Sarasota 2 years ago playing it with the orchestra down there. We got better halls up here, so I'm looking forward to this.
Yes, and we look forward to you and your wife coming to that concert.
Oh, front row.
Yeah, I mean, he's really, and what a gentleman, and what a great, he's used his talent not just for the extraordinary beauty of his cello playing, but at the same time, just the majesty of what music can do to really affect communities in a positive way. He's one of the great ambassadors of the power of our art form.
That's going to be fabulous. You're going to be here for another 10 years, you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've got another 5 years for sure on my contract.
Okay.
And it depends if they want to kick me out by then. But in the meantime, I'm very happy to make music here, see the orchestra grow, and continue to just be part of this astonishingly fast-growing community of Tampa Bay.
Well, keep booking those Babs and Beyond shows.
Easy
and
for
I
you
think
to say.
I think it's a cinch, man. I think you're in.
Triple B, that's it, yeah.
Michael Francis, hey, break a leg, as they say. You're opening Saturday at Ruth Eckert Hall, Saturday and Sunday, with the first Masterworks series of the 57th season of the Florida Orchestra. Many thanks for coming and joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Bill. Thank you very much.
From stpetecatalyst.com.